Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. On tonight's show, we'll do a deep dive into San Francisco City Hall's corruption scandals with Mission Local Managing Editor Joe Eskenazi. Then Grace will sit down with San Francisco's Poet Laureate Tongo Eisen-Martin to talk about his new book.
But first, let's check in on the state of the pandemic with infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF and Chronicle Health reporter Aaron Alday.
It has been one very long year since the Bay Area went into shelter in place. COVID took the lives of more than 5,000 people in the Bay Area, and over 400,000 got sick with it. But with the new spring, spring brings hope. Hospitalizations are down 75% from January 1st. Bay Area counties are all in the red tier now. And most importantly, there's a vaccine.
We're here today with our trusted pandemic team, Aaron Alday and Peter Chin Hong. You guys, welcome back to what's now State of the Bay.
It's so great to be back.
And ditto, I can't believe we're here again.
I mean, it's exactly a year since San Francisco went into shelter in place today. Is that crazy?
It's absolutely crazy. It's hard to even fathom that a year has gone by.
Well, at first I just want to ask, how are you guys doing? Aaron, how have you been holding up over this past year?
It's been a challenge. It's been really exhausting. So, I'm like everybody, I'm hanging in there. And there's so much in my life to be really thankful for. And I really do, you know, have a lot that I value in my life. And one of the most important things, it's been great to feel productive and useful through this pandemic, because I think that's one thing a lot of people have struggled with, is that kind of isolation and feeling like you can't do anything and like your hands are tied as the world is sort of falling apart around us. So, you know, getting to kind of feel that productivity is a real honor. So, so I definitely feel that way, but I will say I'm feeling a lot better now, than I was a year ago or even like a month ago. I'm very curious to hear Peter's thoughts on this, but I'm feeling pretty good about the pandemic in general these days.
Well, let's start with you, Aaron, and Peter, we're going to get to how you're feeling. I think Joseph's going to ask you about that, but you know, everybody wants a vaccine, Aaron, and they want it now. It's been a bumpy rollout. I don't think that's news. So tell us today, they changed who's eligible. So who's eligible now?
Right. So today, they just opened it up. The state did to everybody 16 and up. So the vaccine is approved for authorized for those 16 and older. And the state opened it up to all people in that age group who have disabilities or kind of underlying health conditions that put them at risk of severe disease and death from COVID-19. So that's a pretty big group of people. It's about 4.4 million Californians. In addition to that, we've recently opened up for transit workers, for people who are homeless, people who are in other kind of congregate living situations. So people in correctional facilities and those kinds of spots. So, you know, a pretty big cluster of people that got approved for eligibility in this latest round.
Well, I was down at Moscone Center yesterday helping a friend, dropping her off. And I think that's the happiest place in San Francisco right now. People are just delighted. Well, before we go to Peter, quick question again to you, Aaron. What's the best way to sign up for a vaccine?
Oh, wow. What's the best way? You know, most people I know are just kind of going for myturn.org. So they're using the state website. That's kind of the go-to place. But, you know, I mean, one of the things that's been bumpy and sort of awkward about this rollout is most people I know, I don't know if this has been your experience, people I know who have gotten vaccinated, have gotten lucky, have kind of done it through word of mouth, which is not great. It's not an ideal situation, but doing things like, you know, we heard from a coworker this morning who just was at a pharmacy and asked if he could get vaccinated. And they were like, sure, come on over. They didn't even ask about his eligibility. You know, we have all kinds of anecdotal reports of people, you know, lining up for extra doses at the end of the day. I know my own parents who live in a different county outside the Bay Area got vaccinated because somebody on their kind of neighborhood, you know, email list told them, call this phone number. And it was just a clinic nearby that happened to be serving people. So that's how they got in. So, and that's, you know, it's not great. That's not the way the system should work. But in terms of if people, you know, want to kind of go about it the right way, the best way is to use that state system at this point.
And Peter, I wanted to go to you next. Public health officials are encouraging people to take whichever vaccine is available to them. With three currently available in this country, what's your take on the various vaccines?
Well, Pache, it's so nice to be on. My take is that I'd really be happy with any of the vaccines we have available. The bottom line is all three prevent hospitalizations, deaths, and severe disease to a remarkable extent. So I know people fixate on the overall efficacy rate, but again, as a clinician, I'm most worried about keeping people out of the hospital.
And when you say that people are focusing on the efficacy rate, you're talking about some of the discussion around the Johnson & Johnson efficacy rate. Put that into some perspective for our listeners.
Yeah, so I think, you know, with every vaccine, if you really had to compare and contrast them, there are trade-offs. So I think, you know, with the J&J, people look at that 71% efficacy overall in the U.S. as being different from a 95% efficacy. But then again, the J&J vaccine was studied at a different time in the world. It was a time of variants, whereas Pfizer Moderna was studied earlier on when it was just, well, who would ever think I would say plain old COVID as opposed to the variant. So, you know, I look at that as not only preventing hospitalizations, deaths, but the fact that the J&J vaccine performed well in the face of a South African variant in South Africa where it was studied, or in Brazil where it was studied, and in the U.S. gives me a lot of reason to celebrate. It's a one-stop shopping kind of vaccine. It hasn't caused any of the serious adverse effects like anaphylaxis that we've seen in Pfizer and Moderna, because it doesn't have that lipid bubble. And, you know, there are trade-offs in each of the vaccines. But overall, again, I'll be psyched to get any of them.
So whatever's offered to you, just go ahead and take it. So you mentioned variants. Which variants, and if any, do we really need to worry about here in California? And I know, as we've learned over the last year, it doesn't really mean that what happens in California or other parts of the world have nothing to do with what happens in California. But right now, in this moment, where are we at with variants in California?
So of the pantheon of variants, the one that's probably going to dominate, actually it's already started dominating, is the UK, or the variant first described in the UK, the B117. I know we think about our own California variant, which was first described in Denmark. But if the UK variant and the California variant went in a boxing ring, the UK variant would win out.
And so how prevalent is the UK variant right now in California?
So it's increasing. The California variant is still more common, 50% and higher than 50% in some cases. The UK variant is easing up. And, you know, in the country, it's about 50%, slated to reach 90% overall by the end of the month. But in California, it's starting to predominate, particularly in San Diego and Southern California. So it's in some communities, 25%, if not higher. But it's you know, more transmissible. So I think it's just a matter of time before it becomes a dominant California variant.
And could a vaccinated person maybe pick up one of these variants and pass it on to someone else who's not vaccinated?
Well, I think the evidence is accruing more and more that vaccines do prevent transmission. We have a couple of good studies from Israel. We have a good study from the UK, and we have actual data from J&J. So when we think about transmission, the group of people we want to make sure it's protected against is the people who, if the vaccine prevents asymptomatic transmission or asymptomatic infection, sorry, because if you prevent asymptomatic infection, you're most likely going to prevent transmission, since that's responsible for more than 50% of the cases.
Well, Peter, you know, listeners always have questions about vaccines. And so before I turn back to Aaron, a quick question for you. The question is, if I get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine with a lower efficacy rate, do I need to worry about contracting COVID and transmitting it, even if I don't get very sick?
That is a possibility. I think with 30% folks not, you know, being protected from infection, there is a chance that you could get, you know, infected, even though you're not going to get very sick, go to the hospital and die. And that's the reason why I think with a mixture and not everybody reaching herd immunity yet, or a large number of people not getting vaccinated yet, increasing though, we can't really go out, vaccinated people can't go out into society for that reason.
Yeah, and that brings up the point, the world is opening up. And Aaron, you know, now what can we do now that we're in the red tier?
Wow, there's kind of a lot of things we can do. You know, we're back. I mean, it's exciting. It's easy to kind of lose track of you know, what people are allowed to do and what they're not. You know, we've got indoor dining, you know, open up in all the counties now. This was really important and exciting for Sonoma County in particular, which had never gotten out of the purple tier. But just as of Sunday, finally made it into that red tier and is on its way. That to me was a big sign of hope. You know, we're seeing gyms opening up again, and just, you know, kind of more capacity at a lot of places. I was just talking to somebody that San Mateo County is probably going to go into the orange tier tomorrow. And that means, you know, things like, you know, bowling alleys and bars could even open outdoors again, bars that don't serve food, which would be, you know, the first time that's happened in, I think, maybe a year. I was just, we're trying to do the math on that one. But it's kind of, I mean, one of the disadvantages of this tier structure is it gets really confusing. It can be hard for people to keep track of what's open and what's not. But, you know, we've all kind of been through this before, I think, so people are starting to get the hang of it a little bit more. And it's mostly just, you know, most things that most of us kind of want to do, you can, you know, find a safe way to do it in this environment, in this kind of red tier. Like, you can go out and you can go out to dinner. You can go to, you know, the nail salon. You can get kind of the facial or the massage. Like, all these things are open. It's just that there are kind of restrictions on how to do that safely.
I don't think people have cared so much about primary colors in their life as they have this past year with the red, orange, and yellow. So you can go out, but you still need to wear a mask, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Nowhere in California are we seeing that mask mandate lifting. And I don't see that changing anytime soon in California at all.
Well, one painful issue that we're going to be talking a lot about in our coming episodes is schools. What's just every county, every district seems to be a little bit different. But with public schools, Aaron, is there a general sense that kids will get back in the classrooms?
That's such a tough one. I mean, yes, you know, we're starting to make some progress there. You know, both San Francisco and, I believe as of today, Oakland, you know, have reached agreements. They do have these sort of plans in place and have worked it out with the teachers to get some kids back into some classes, at least, you know, some of the time. So presumably, you know, sometime in April, we'll be seeing some of that happen in some of these school districts that have been holdouts for the whole time. You know, we're not going to have regular kind of full-time kids in classrooms like they're used to before the end of the school year on, you know, as a rule of thumb. And I think the hope is that we will be back at that place in the fall, you know, when school returns in the fall, that everybody will be ready to do that. We'll be ready to get all the kids and all grade levels back in those classrooms, you know, full-time and safely.
So Peter, this year has taught us that our lives have become a cycle of fits and starts. We've been talking about reopening. We're talking about the excitement of vaccinations. And yet I'm hearing concerns about a surge coming in April. What's your take on that? And what would be behind it?
Well, Pache, I wish I could be more optimistic. And usually I am. But I'm fearful of another surge. I mean, if you look globally, Italy went on lockdown again, essentially today. The rest of European countries are seeing the surge begin again in the face of vaccinations. And in the U.S., it's PTSD for me, public health PTSD from spring of 2020, when you have the same group of folks who moved around during spring break already moving around to Florida beaches and other states that are completely open, like Texas, South Padre Island. I'm worried that they'll be also traveling to Mexico, which has a low vaccination rate. So, and then we've seen progress stall in New York. Michigan is seeing an increase in cases. So a patchwork response in the U.S. and increased mobility leads me to worry that with a group of unvaccinated folks being mobile, that we are going to see an increase in numbers.
And how long do you think this surge will last? Is it going to be months again? Will the fact that many people have been vaccinated, will it cut into the length of that surge and the peak of it.
Yeah, so I don't think it will be the same kind of COVID surge we've been seeing in the first three in California. This will look very different. Most of the folks who are at risk of doing poorly, those in nursing homes accountable for more than 75% of deaths, and those over 65 have already been, for the large part, vaccinated or in the process of being so. So what we will see is just cases in the community. And what I'm really concerned about is the increasing reports of long hauler syndrome and chronic symptoms related to COVID, even if you have a mild case. And so I'm a little bit worried about that. But, you know, again, we can do our part and prevent that increase. And I hope I'm proven wrong.
So, say more about this idea that with even being vaccinated, that you could get a mild case of COVID and still get long haul symptoms. This is another area that continues to expand and baffle us and make people crazy.
Yes, it is crazy. That's why, you know, at the end of the day, you just don't want to get COVID, period. It sounds very trite to say, but it is. SARS-CoV-2 is an infection that I have such respect for because we're learning so much about it every day. And just today, you know, I was speaking to a reporter on the East Coast who got COVID, I think, more than 6 months ago, and she still can't smell. And I'm just worried that that will lead to a lot of people, young people, others who are going to be pulled out of work, of school, for these chronic symptoms that will probably go away, but will take a long time to go away. I think in terms of estimates, they go between 10% on one range to 33% in the studies. And they are mainly in women, unfortunately. And we still don't know how best to manage them.
That is a fear. I mean, that is actually my husband's question about getting long-haul symptoms with a mild case of COVID. But another issue that's come up, Aaron, and is that vaccine equity, that the communities that are most hard hit with COVID are either not getting access to the vaccine or people are jumping in lines ahead of them. What are the counties doing about that?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think we knew going into this vaccination rollout that was going to be a problem. I mean, the whole equity issue has been a huge. I mean, it's kind of been to me one of the defining issues of this pandemic is just how completely disproportionate the effects of this pandemic have been right out of the gate, starting back in March, and now we're seeing it play out in this rollout. I will say, at least it seems like we've did a little bit better job preparing for it this time around, and I know there has been a lot of emphasis in the counties of, you know, bringing sort of the vaccine to the communities that are hardest hit, trying to improve that access. But it's something that, you know, our health structure, our entire health system structure is built up to kind of be inequitable, to kind of not, you know, to have issues with that basic kind of access to care. And this is how we're seeing that play out. So it's just going to be an uphill battle the whole way through. I think, you know, when it comes to things like the line jumping, I'm always really careful to not, I don't want to blame the people who are necessarily, you know, getting that access, because I don't think it's quite, you can't simply say that these people are like stealing vaccines from other communities. It's just, that's just not how this plays out.
Right.
You know, it's more that we just need to figure out a much better way to, when we get these supplies, to send them, to make sure that they get diverted, that we find creative, really productive ways to get those vaccines to the people who are most at risk, most vulnerable, that need it the most. And we clearly aren't quite doing that yet. I think it's just going to be a work in progress. I think we're just going to have to work hard at it kind of throughout the end of this thing. And later when we get boosters, presumably, you know, this isn't just going to end when we magically reach some number of people vaccinated and then we can wipe our hands of it. So it's just going to be kind of a constant thing.
Well, so there's no magical thinking here, but I did want to take a moment to thank the both of you. You guys have been great throughout the year for our listeners. Aaron Alde providing great healthcare information and Peter Chin Hong being on the front lines. So thanks from all of us at KLW to all the hard work you've done and on this year anniversary of sorts. So that was Aaron Alde, the health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. So great to be back.
And let's have a birthday cake sometime.
Absolutely. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll hear from Joe Eskenazi, the managing editor of Mission Local. He's been keeping a close watch on the corruption scandals in San Francisco city government. Where does this end? And could this eventually be traced to Mayor London Breed?
We want you to be part of the conversation. Give us a call with questions or comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us a message. We're on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Welcome back to State of the Bay. We can't think of anyone better than Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local, to help explain the expanding corruption scandals in San Francisco's City Hall. The scandal includes charges of bribery and fraud at Public Works and the Department of Building Inspection. So far, five city department heads have resigned. But how much farther will this go? To answer that question, we're pleased to welcome back Joe Eskenazi. Welcome to the new State of the Bay, Joe.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So this is a complicated web of corruption. If we had a whiteboard, we could start drawing a diagram, but you're going to have to do that with words. So tell us about who's in trouble and what they did so that our listeners can get a sense of where we've been in the last year of these growing scandals in City Hall.
Well, sure thing. In January of 2020, the FBI arrested Mohammed Nuru, who was the longtime head of the Public Works Department. And he was charged with not only participation in a bribery scheme, but he was also charged with lying to the feds because he allegedly told them that he would keep his mouth shut about the investigation. And you can insinuate that they wanted to use him to bring in everybody like a Trojan horse. And instead, he went and started telling people. So they're going to be angry because now they have to make all the cases, and they are methodically going through and going after people. Among other people who have been pulled down so far, Harlan Kelly, the longtime head of the Public Utilities Commission, is charged with also in a bribery scheme. We also have Walter Wong, the permit expediter and contractor. Sandra Zuniga, who was listed as girlfriend one in the charging documents against Nuru, and also worked in the mayor's office, and we'll talk more about that. Rodrigo Santos, a engineer, is charged with check fraud and also very bad construction practices, and the list goes on.
Includes Naomi Kelly, Harlan Kelly's wife, who is
been charged, but she did resign.
Sorry, mm-hmm. But city administrator, yeah.
And Tom Hui, the head of the Department of Building Inspection, also resigned. He was implicated in a city attorney probe, essentially turning over control of the Department of Building Inspection to Walter Wong.
And just today, you reported that the DA's office is investigating the Department of Building Inspection. Why is this significant? What kind of a turn in events does this indicate?
Well, this is something I've heard from multiple sources, and the DA's office itself didn't talk about this, as you wouldn't expect them to. You don't talk about Fight Club. But multiple sources did confirm it to me. And this is significant because the city attorney has been going through and getting good results with their integrity probe. But the city attorney deals in the matter of civil law and civil penalties. But the DA, not the city attorney, the district attorney, deals in criminal law. So this is a matter where the investigation appears to be a white collar crime. And, to speculate just only a little bit, I think that you're looking at the difference in allegations between an improper gift and a bribe. And that can be a big deal. And if the district attorney's office feels that the evidence rises to it, then it will bring criminal charges.
Well, Joe, I had to laugh because in an article last year, you wrote that San Francisco is either, quote, a dysfunctional government or a functional cartel. And from what you've described, it does sound both like both. And I understand there's even an element with Recology, like this garbage fire, dumpster fire has a garbage element. What's that?
Well, earlier this month, City Attorney Dennis Herrera gave everyone a couple hours head start, and he said there'd be a significant development in his ongoing integrity campaign. And so people started wondering who is going to be in trouble or what is going to be in trouble. And and I guessed it would be Recology, and I was correct. And that's not because I'm a fortune teller, but it's because that was where things were going. In October, I wrote for Mission Local about how, isn't it interesting how the majority of the funds in these slush funds that Mohamed Nuru controlled came from Recology? And isn't it interesting that while this money was going into these slush funds, your garbage rates went up 20%? Well, a month later, the feds made charges along those lines, alleging that this was no accident and that it was a very crass quid pro quo between Nuru and individuals at Recology. If, you know, certainly it's not the whole company, but it seemed that it was people who could write out checks. And it was something as simple as this money going to Mohamed Nuru and employment of his teenage son or young son. And then in the process of all this, Dennis Herrera's office uncovered that Recology did not account for income that it was making in the year 2017 and thereby asked for too high of a garbage rate hike and was granted it. So they were entitled to ask for a 7-ish percent hike and they got a 14% hike. So there's a $95 million settlement in which they're paying back to all of us in little chunks, kind of like the end of the movie, The Jerk. They're paying back each little checks of this giant amount. What makes this even more interesting is that, you know, one of my fellow journalists asked City Attorney Herrera during his press conference, is this a scheme or was this an accident? And he didn't answer. And I think it's hard to say it was a scheme because as early as 2018 or early 2019, Recology confirmed to the city that they made a mistake. Mm. And city officials knew this, but nobody did anything about it. So that's not exculpatory for Recology because they didn't change anything. They kept collecting the inflated amount. But it also means that more people are to blame and that we have more work to do sorting out what went wrong here, because city officials did know that the people of San Francisco were being overcharged and nothing was changed until legal repercussions were threatened by the city attorney.
Well, I often think that, you know, these scandals feel so far away and not part of everybody's day-to-day life. But when you hear that you've been paying, you know, 14% more on your garbage bill than you should be because somebody has a slush fund, that makes you angry. Are we going to see rebates on our garbage bills or are we going to get a check?
The answer is yes. I don't know if it's going to be a check or if it's going to be credits or what, but I think it averages out to between $160 and $190 is what an individual ratepayer who isn't, you know, running some manner of big business with lots of garbage and whatnot should get. So that's a fair amount of money. And then also the rates after 3 months, and you should get that by September. And then after 3 months, the rates will go down to what they should have been. And that will also save you some money.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking to Mission Local Managing Editor Joe Eskenazi about corruption in City Hall. What do you think about what's going on in City Hall? And have you been affected? Are you looking forward to a Recology rebate? You can join our program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. You know, another thing that you've reported, Joe, is that the former mayor, Ed Lee, who passed away, he actually let Nuru, Mohamed Nuru, have oversight of himself. Like, he didn't seem to have a supervisor. Is that how things are done at City Hall, or was that an unusual situation?
Again, the answer to both of those is yes. There are strange details like that, but it is unusual to give someone oversight over himself. And I believe you have, thank you for reading, and you have unearthed a salient but well-buried detail in one of these stories that Ed Lee changed the rules so that in the matter of, I believe, transactions of up to $10 million, it was significant transactions that that Nuru didn't have anybody overseeing it. There was no final authority looking at the charges. And of course, Department of Public Works doesn't have or didn't have, it's going to soon have because of all this, it didn't have a board that oversees it the way that many other city agencies do, like Public Utilities Commission, like the police, like so many, you know. And so that is just not good government. And especially when you have someone like Mohamed Nuru, it's kind of a, you know, a recipe for disaster.
And my understanding, Joe, is that there was some investigations that perhaps were pointing towards Mayor Ed Lee. And obviously things went in a very different direction. Had the mayor not passed away, where do you think this could have gone?
It's hard to say, and we may never know, because I don't know how much effort the feds are going to put into, putting charges against a deceased person. But it's very hard not to read the charging documents for Harlan Kelly and look over the sections in which he and Walter Wong had a coded, description for Mayor Lee, which was 35, which is EL on a keypad, and not think that it just seemed very clear that Ed Lee was the initial target of this long-running federal investigation. And that's not to say that Ed Lee is guilty of anything. There are plenty of people throughout the history of the United States who have been investigated by the feds and were quite innocent, and investigations do not equate guilt. But, there is an awful lot of corruption and malfeasance in San Francisco in the last decade, and we would do well not to be surprised by anything. But it did, I can't say for certain, but it certainly, one got the impression that the feds were looking into Ed Lee. And certainly during the whole Shrimp Boy fiasco, I believe an undercover agent with a wire went in and talked to Ed Lee, but the mayor didn't say anything untoward. And it wasn't part of their charging.
Well, staying with Mohamed Nuru, then, his schemes were for personal benefit, as we've heard or seen in your reporting and the reporting of others, like getting lots of things to help build his ranch, a free tractor, free materials and labor. But some of his schemes actually benefited DPW employees, such as providing funds for department holiday parties. What is it, in your view, about the culture of San Francisco's government that emboldened these employees, these public servants, to act this way?
Well, looking at Nuru and taking it current, we can look at the interminable debate about the Ferris wheel in Golden Gate Park. And, you know, many people couldn't give a good goddamn about a Ferris wheel, but there are little red flags there, such as that all the money went to for the leasing goes to the Friends, the Parks Alliance. It goes to the Friends group, the Parks Alliance. And throughout the city, you have these Friends groups that are nonprofits that essentially can act as a way for department heads to kind of skirt regulation in the best of times, just to get around the annoying busybody members of the Board of Supervisors, but in the worst of times, to do things like what Mohamed Nuru did, which is to use it like a slush fund, which was his personal piggy bank, and he used it to be the big man on campus and throw this crazy party every year. And the list of things that he bought in the federal charging documents really read like, you know, some kind of Daytona Beach spring break bonanza, with booze and DJs and paraphernalia, and then, you know, additional booze runs when they ran out of more booze. And it wasn't just public works employees. I'm told it was a hot ticket and people came from all around the quote unquote city family. So, you know, this is a way to, what it said within the charging documents is that Recology gleaned quickly that it would behoove them to keep Muhammad happy. And this is how you did it. You enabled him to be the master of ceremonies.
Well, it's ironic that Mohamed Nuru called himself Mr. Clean. And, you know, he's been on this show before, and we talked a lot about how he kept the city streets clean. And I recall a listener saying, wow, that is the most responsive city official I've ever heard from. And yet all of this was going on behind the scenes. It's a little bit disappointing.
He exploited a market inefficiency. Because the system didn't work, you had to rely on an individual. And so people who had his number and who had clout and whose favor he wished to curry, he could be very effective, but not for you or me. If I called up Mohamed Nuru and said, there's a pile of refuse in front of my house, I don't think that there would be much of a response. You know, I have similar experiences to lots of people of waiting months and months and months and months and having a tree, you know, grow up into the power lines and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you were, you know, a mover and a shaker or a city supervisor or something like that, it paid to be on his good side and things could move quickly.
It kind of goes to how people feel about the city budget. It's in the billions of dollars, and yet many people in the city feel like they're not getting the services that they're paying for. This kind of goes to a listener comment that we got, which is, quote, "It's sad to hear that Recology may have been involved in corruption, as I find them a very responsive company who is also known for treating their workers well. What does this say about their future with San Francisco? Does Recology have that market sewn up there, Joe?"
I think it would take a lot of effort and perhaps more findings of wrongdoing to get people to do otherwise. Supervisor Aaron Peskin is putting together a task force to look into potentially municipalizing Recology, but that's a heavy ask, especially now that money is not going to be, you know, flowing down the trough. You know, I like to take my family to Heron's Head Park. When you go to Heron's Head Park, you're looking at the Pier 96 recycling facility. So let's say that we overturn the 89-year-old ordinance that gives Recology a monopoly on waste hauling throughout San Francisco. We could go in a couple different ways. We could go into open bidding, but Recology has the high ground here. Essentially, everyone else would have to charge the beach, and they already have fortified bunkers because they have all of the facilities and they have all of the vehicles and they have all of the they have the hardware and the software. So that would be very hard for someone to come up with a competitive bid accounting for that. Maybe impossible. So let's say you municipalize, then you'd have to come up with a lot of money in order to get all this stuff off of them. And then, you know, you would have to override the public sentiment that the city is not the most well-run place and how you want to run the garbage service that, you know, despite this this corruption, Recology's rates are not astoundingly bad for San Franciscans. They're not the worst of anybody in the Bay Area. And the service is at best very good and at worst, you know, not terrible. So I don't think that there's a hue and cry to do that yet. But, you know, we don't know what they're going to find next.
Yeah.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache here with Grace Wan, and we are speaking with Joe Eskenazi, who's managing editor of Mission Local. And we're talking about the bevy of corruption scandals in City Hall. We'd like to hear your opinions on how the city should reset its course. You can join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, Joe, this scandal is getting awfully close to Mayor Breed. Former city administrator Naomi Kelly is married to former PUC head Harlan Kelly, who was charged, as you mentioned. As city administrator, Naomi Kelly held the city's purse strings and answered to Breed. And Nehru's current girlfriend, Sandra Zuniga, worked in the mayor's office. And it is well known that Mayor Breed also dated Nehru years back. How much risk is she in?
Well, that's the unknowable question, because we don't know what she has to hide. And, you know, one could also say she may have nothing to hide. And, you know, she may be the one who skates out of this cleanly, and deservedly so. What we could say is there was a great hullabaloo made of her past, you know, for lack of a better term, boyfriend-girlfriend type relationship with Mohamed Nehru. That never struck me as being all that big a deal, because Mohamed Nehru was elevated and enabled and empowered by a series of San Francisco mayors with whom he did not have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. I believe he was brought into the department at Willie Brown's behest. He was elevated to the top of the department by Ed Lee. He served Gavin Newsom and Lee and Mark Farrell. So all of these people let Mohamed Nehru do Mohamed Nehru things. The issue of him paying for the mayor's car repairs is a problem, and that will probably result in fines, you know, with state ethical bodies. As far as Sandra Zuniga, she was in the mayor's office, and she was also the head of the mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services. And with this mayor and with every mayor, so this is not a swipe at Mayor Breed, the mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services is essentially politics as government. You know, it's It's always.
What do you mean by that? What's politics as government mean?
It's doing stuff to keep voters happy. You know, it's it always walks that fine line between politics and government, you know, and it's a bit redundant too, because there's other ways to, we have your neighborhood representatives and you also have your mayor's office of neighborhood services. And suffice to say, it's somebody who could be empowered to do things that are not necessarily unethical, but like cheap populism type things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that anybody is guilty of federal crimes or any crimes. It just means that if there is anything bad, it would seem that Sandra Zuniga is in a position to know about it. That's the worry if there is anything bad. But again, and I want to make this resplendently clear, if Mayor Breed hasn't done anything wrong or hasn't done anything worthwhile wrong, then there's nothing to know. But with Sandra Zuniga agreeing to cooperate, that, you know, there's a lot that could come out. She has admitted to a money laundering conspiracy that traces back to 2010. That's a lot of time. And yeah. She has been in the room for a long time. And she has been, you know, in the middle of a lot of things. You know, the tractor that Mohamed Nuru was purportedly bribed with was delivered in her name so as to conceal the transaction. These are the kind of things that could come out in the near future. But again, you know, if any particular individuals haven't been doing these things, then those particular individuals will not be implicated.
I mean, the plot feels like a Scorsese film, I have to be honest. There is just so much corruption in so many different places. But let's talk about City Attorney Dennis Herrera. He's been doing a lot of the investigation, and he's proposed tighter controls on city contracts as a result of these charges. Do you know what the new controls are, and are they going to be enough?
Off the top of my head, Grace, I'm sorry, I don't know what they are. I think that you can certainly stamp out, you could certainly close, there's lots that could be done. But I think I would love to see tighter controls. I would love to see, you know, more oversight. But more than that, I think that San Francisco has for decades not really had a culture of accountability. And this is not as specific as the kinds of things that come out of the controller's office or the city attorney's office, which can get maddeningly specific. But there is just generally a culture where people, separate and apart from the wrongdoing that we've all been discussing, there's not really accountability just for poor performance or wasting money or just, you know, bad behavior. So it's quite a haul. It's going to take quite a bit. You will not change the San Francisco ethos by getting rid of a few people at the top, especially because those people at the top have spent years seeding the middle and the bottom.
Well,
and
let's take a quick.
When you're out of government, you can make a phone call and you can get what you want.
Well, let's take a quick call. We have Frank from San Francisco. We're go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
My comment was that the Carmen Chu went from being the city assessor to being the new COO, and she was being reported widely around the city as having reduced her own assessments on her own personal residence without any oversight by anybody. And that's kind of smelly, I would think. Or am I wrong?
Well, yeah, let's take that question. Thanks for your call, Frank. And
thank
Joe,
you.
In the minute that we have left, Carmen Chu, is she implicated in this at all?
Not in this wave of corruption. The allegation, unless I'm mistaken, is that this occurred not directly with her, but under a prior assessor. But there were stories about this, and it does bear investigation. Carmen Chu also does have a reputation for competence, and I think that's what they wanted at this time.
All right. Well, Joe, thanks so much. It's great to know that you're reporting this story. That's Joe Eskenazi. He's the managing editor of Mission Local. If you haven't checked out that publication, definitely find it on the web. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Next up, Grace sits down with San Francisco's poet laureate, Tongo Eisen Martin. Stay with us. This is State of the Bay. Thank you.
Last week, I sat down over Zoom with San Francisco poet laureate Tongo Eisenmartin. Tongo was born and raised in San Francisco. He's an educator, publisher, and activist who has fought against mass incarceration and police brutality. Eisenmartin's book, Heaven Is All Goodbyes, received the 2018 California Book Award for Poetry, a 2018 American Book Award, and was shortlisted for the Griffin Poetry Prize. Welcome to State at the Bay, and congratulations on being named San Francisco's 8th Poet Laureate.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, first tell me, what does the Poet Laureate do?
I think the Poet Laureate is an improvised or improvising position where you basically you get access to all of these like San Francisco Public Library resources, including the imaginations of the groovy people who work there, and you kind of just go forth and be fruitful. I've just kind of extended myself to any and all institutions, organizations, agencies that want to collaborate, especially on educational projects. I think that's crucial to doing kind of cultural work right now, or looking at cultural work as the expansion of consciousness, and using poetry as a tool for expanding consciousness. That's my preoccupation right now.
I love it. I love the expansion of consciousness. Well, how did you get involved in poetry? What's your backstory?
I went to Meadows Livingstone Elementary School, which is a freedom school in San Francisco that centered Black people and Black resistance and centered in our identities the mandate that what you do is for your people and it is for the struggle. And so these figures of the Harlem Renaissance and later the Gil Scott Herons are almost presented as family to you. And so there was a Langston Hughes poem. I think it's the conversation between the son and the mother. And I forget if it was an assignment to respond with a poem or lines just began jumping into my head. But what I do remember was there was a shift. Not that I was like struck by any kind of light or got a glimpse of the future or anything like that, but I could kind of feel myself almost physically thinking differently as I was putting the poem together. And I think that was, I don't know if you'd call that kind of like the ear piercing of it or whatever veil might have been lifted, but that's where it begins. So it's poetry really does not leave my mind alone. Along the way, I've had different incarnations as a writer, but it began with Black people as cosmological center. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hear one of your poems. Could you read an excerpt for us? I was thinking about Faceless from your book, Heaven Is All Goodbyes.
The start of mass destruction begins and ends in restaurant bathrooms that some people use and other people clean. Are you telling me there's a rag in the sky? Yeah. Waiting for you, yes. We've written a scene. We set a stage. We should have fit in. Warehouse jobs are for communists, but now more corridor and hallway have walked into our lives. Now the whistling is less playful and the barbed wire overcrowded too, my dear. If it is not a city, it is a prison. If it has a prison, it is a prison, not a city.
Wow. I mean, that expands the consciousness, that's for sure. I mean, that excerpt, like your work as an educator and movement worker, it takes on injustice, politics, power structures, and survival. Do you consider your poetry a call to action?
It is definitely a call to action, but to be more specific, it's a call to praxis. It's a call to, think about the world critically, do something about these critical thoughts. It's a call to critical engagement of reality as engined by analysis and practice and more analysis and practice.
I think that is a lot like the first poet laureate, who is Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And he often said that art could be transformative. And in his own life, he tried to be that way. You know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti died recently. And I wonder, did you have any thoughts about his passing and what he means to San Francisco?
Yeah, I mean, you know, blessed be the founders of the carnival, you know, the builders of the pirate ships, you know. Also, you know, rest in peace to Miguel Algarin, who passed away not too long ago, who was the founder of the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, in which I was really schooled well. They might be the most important position in art. Those that create the circuses that the rest of us wanderers kind of happen upon and grow through.
Why is that? Why do you think that's the most important position in art? The creator of the circus.
Because you know, without it, you know, so much of almost a renaissance or a modernization of an art form is so conversational and is really based on people just working close together, you know, and working closely, even hanging out and becoming part of each other's lives. And every time my craft accelerated, there were collectives there that I was just trying to do right by.
Yeah, that reminds me of something you said when you accepted the position as poet laureate. You said, as deep into the various communities of the city as our poets have already brought the craft, I want to push even further into places where poetry has not yet permeated. What did you mean by that?
Where poetry is, you know, where kind of people's art is as pronounced, if not more pronounced, than other, you know, really than the kind of hegemonic thinking that has us engaging art as compartment of reality or a facet of reality that you don't necessarily need to engage in order to participate in society. So just thinking about, you know, art as crucial and perpetual as any one of your major organs, when you have people who understand their lives this way or reproduce themselves through more dynamic processes of thinking and relating to the world, oppressors have a lot harder time keeping us in check.
Well, you're also a publisher. You have the Black Freighter Press, and I think you opened that last year, and its motto is, where the collective determines cultural reality. So back to that creation of the circus, tell me what it's like to be a publisher and what you're seeing out there, what you're excited about.
Well, you know, I'm excited about, you know, this just the prospect of kind of capturing cultural production. You know, and just kind of creating a people structure to facilitate cultural reality so that, you know, it's actually a socially inhibiting thing, regardless of how, you know, big and bad a resistance poet I might be, as long as everything I do is facilitated, frankly, by bourgeois institutions or institutions that are beholden to the bourgeoisie, there's actually only so much social potential, and there's always a kind of a contradiction built into the effort. So a big part of the objective of Black Freighter Press is to just take cultural processes and put it into people's hands.
You know, as they say, it's not always the destination, it's the journey. And that seems like the journey that you're bringing people on, which is amazing. You know, I'd love to close by asking you to read an excerpt from your poem, Pennies for the Opera.
Forestry of drug paraphernalia, suburb spikes in the grass, syringe jungle like a sick bed, execution needle that became a society's bottleneck. Preamble news talk or nuclear scientists thank for their work, activists who don't scream black power, rather black component. a painful season. Season gone sentient and well-dressed, taken as a whole, taken in puppet skin, a sentient Sunday that married 15 sticks of dynamite. We are houseless now and dancing our waistlines into a courtroom floor, Atlantic Ocean, throwing my voice into the city weeds of the other Confederacy. I would double down on this poem, on this gang friendship, signs of apocalypse in all directions. I would run this poem into the ground.
So powerful. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Where can we find you reading? Like, where can our listeners find you next?
Well, actually, Black Freighter, we're throwing a monthly event every last Friday at 6 p.m. It's going to be in the Bayview Opera House when the world thaws out. But for now, it'll be online. I don't have the Zoom digits in my head.
Should we look out at Black Freighter Press? Is there a website?
Yes, blackfreighterpress.com.
So for our listeners who want to hear some more powerful readings from Tongo Eisenmartin, head over to Black Freighter Press. So I want to thank you, Tongo Eisenmartin, for being on State of the Bay. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear your work.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you. Much love.
That was my interview of San Francisco Poet Laureate Tongo Eisenmartin. He'll be inaugurated as Poet Laureate on April 21st, and his upcoming poetry collection, Blood on the Fog, comes out in September.
Welcome to
State of the Bay page on the KALW website for more on Tongo.
Well, that's State of the Bay for this week.
Tongo Eisenmartin may be the coolest poet in San Francisco.
You got it, Grace. I can't wait to pick up his latest book.
And of course, we want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
Grace, what are you looking forward to next week's show?
I'm looking forward to hearing about more people getting vaccinated. And next Monday, we'll hear your interview with Dr. Linda Hsu. She's talking about her new cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen. And our co-host, Ethan Elkind, will join me as we talk about pandemic learning loss with Lakeisha Young of Oakland Reach.
And if you want to send us a question for Lakeisha Young, email us at stateofbay@gmail.com or send us a tweet at stateofbay.
For a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on klw.org.
Our engineer this evening was the mighty D Minor, and tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb, Susie Britton, and Chris Nooney.
I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Joseph Pache.
Good night, and thanks for listening.
Stay safe and have a great week.